Okay, guess it's time to start again. I guess some of you are expecting some feedback on the first delivery you had. Half or around two-thirds of you have gotten it now. When you haven't gotten it, it's just a coincidence that nothing to do with it, that it is not accepted or anything, and you will get new opportunities. Thing is, I lost my student assistant here this year, so I had to go through them, and I started late, so that's my excuse there. But you will get this feedback within a few days now, the rest of you who haven't gotten it. The topic for today is hypothesis testing or null hypothesis significance testing, which is often called how we keep or throw away a null hypothesis, and I'll get more to the details there later. What I'm playing here now on the that's part of the theme today. The other theme is we're trying to say a little bit about ethics and ethics in research in general. What I'm playing up in on the screen here now is just it's called a Queenix board, and it illustrates one of the problems that we face and one of the requirements or assumptions that we make when we observe a phenomena. It's called a Queenix board or a Galton board. We are here looking at two phenomena, or let's say we look at the difference between master students or and bachelor students at some skill thing. One of them are red and one are green. They actually are different from one another, meaning that they come from different places up on top of the screen there. Right, the red one comes a little bit on this side, the green one comes on that side. So the actual score, the actual starting point, that's the true value of these things. But what we observe, and this is typically the thing when it comes to observing a phenomena, it tends to vary because of many, maybe random, maybe structured things. But things vary, and when there are things that affect something, could be genetics, could have something to do with climate change, I don't know, temperatures. Things are not so clear anymore. So if we see here, and there is a 50% chance of getting right and left here, and this picture we see is somewhat, well, now it's been running for a few minutes, so it's beginning to get a bit clearer. The red one seems to be on this side, the green one seems to be on this side. But in the beginning, when you have few observations and you want to say something about the true situation, the most extreme red could be all the way to the left, and the most extreme green could probably be appear somewhere. Actually, we see here a green that's the second but highest value, while the mean score for that is down there. And it's this is the phenomena that we want to statistically to see if this big thing we have down here actually represent two different things. Does it represent two different populations or two different starting points up there, or does it only represent one? It's getting pretty clear now, isn't it? But in many cases, there is a huge overlap between things like this. So let's say we were investigating temperatures at a given day 100 years ago and now, or something like that? Well, even if there have been a slight change on top, that it has become warmer or something like that, the picture we will see here for a given day can be can vary quite a lot. So it's a huge overlap on these things. And as I said, we want to check if the pretty messy thing we have here are two populations or are only one population. And I said population is then based on where they come from on the top. Maybe a bit unclear, but this usually, when you have a phenomena like this, you also end up, if you let this run long enough, you end up in this case with two different normal distributions on the bottom here. And the normal distribution is an assumption we make for a lot of phenomena that has variance to it. It goes for our height, probably weight, shoe numbers. These are human phenomena, but also for a lot of other phenomena that we have in the world. A lot of the what you call the inferential statistics that we do, we try to check out whether our observations are coming from one or two or several populations, has to do with an assumption that the phenomena that we observe have some kind of a variability. And the normal variability that we have an assumption of in a lot of statistics has to do with the what we call the normal distribution. And in a normal distribution, most of the observations are in the center, while fewer and fewer are in the ends. And this is there is quite a rapid drop in a normal distribution like this. We have statistical ways of expressing the distribution. In this case, we use the standard deviation, and that's the normal thing to do. And in the range of plus minus one standard deviation from the center, we should have approximately 68-point-something percent of the total observations. When we move out two standard deviations, we are up to 94% of the observations. And it's then highly unlikely to have three standard deviations up, for instance. As I said, a lot of phenomena that we observe are like this in my field. For instance, we are, if you are looking at a phenomena like intelligence, for instance, we often express that in an IQ score. And the IQ score is based on that IQ is normally distributed. And for IQ, the score is, you could say, the standard deviation that we are dealing with are 15 points. So if this was a distribution of IQ scores, you would see 68% of scores in the range, or 68% of the scores in the range from 85 to 115. The likelihood of having more, for instance, more than two standard deviations up, more than an IQ of 130, would be 2.2% or something like that. So if you have a score like that, 98% are scoring lower than you are. So we can use this to say something about the population, your position in the population. But we also use this to see when we have two populations. Let's say you are comparing two different distributions. Maybe one for, well, let's take the basic one. Let's say we take height in centimeters then, something like that, for boys and girls. Of course, they will have a different average. So let's say the average for boys are 175 or something like that, while for girls it is 165, I don't know. So there is a pretty, you can see a good difference there. Similar to what we saw in this ball drop thing. So you have two distributions, but they overlap quite a bit. And the you could say the when you do an observation, for instance, in a population, the tallest one could be a girl very well. If we had a sample and you took random people in, you could very well get a girl to be the highest one, even though there is a difference in the mean score. But we can then use statistical methods to determine whether this overlap that we have between the two populations, because there will probably be another distribution that looks like this or something. And what we do in statistics then is to determine whether the difference that we see between these two distributions are there because of chance, or if it's highly unlikely to get the difference that we observe based on chance. So that's what we do when we do hypothesis testing. So we assume that a phenomena has variance to it. Of course, not all phenomena has this. I guess if you take out variability and you do calculations on how well an algorithm works, and you give it the same input every time, more or less, and you compare two different algorithms in how effective they are, you could have a situation where this is pretty clear and where there are no overlap and probably hardly any variability at all. But for a lot of phenomena, you will have this type of situation, at least when we for this exercise and for the clear-cut use of methodology thinking in quantitative methodologies, we make these assumptions. I have mentioned the word hypothesis quite a few times, and a hypothesis is, you could say, a qualified, ideally at least, a qualified prediction or guess of an outcome. So when you have a research problem, the hypothesis will try to say something about the outcome that you will have. Let's say in the Kansas article that you were reading, the Kansas paper, the scientific hypothesis would be to say that the flatness ratio of the state of Kansas will be higher than the than it will be for a pancake, if that was their guess. And that is the scientific hypothesis, which we usually call H1. And that is then referred to or discussed against something we call the null hypothesis. And it's this null hypothesis we always test. And the null hypothesis is usually, in almost all cases, an assumption that there are no difference. So a null hypothesis in the case of the Kansas article would probably be something like there are no difference in the flatness ratio between Kansas and a pancake. In that case, you could probably also be a bit creative and say that the null hypothesis is the common expectations, and that is that Kansas isn't flatter than a pancake or something like that. But that would be a special case. The normal thing is to say that there are no difference, and that's the null hypothesis. And as I said, it's this null hypothesis that we test. So what we then do when we do, I'll open the statistical program I have here later, and I'll just do a little exercise where I do a little bit of this hypothesis testing. But what we tend to refer to here often is what we call a significance level. And significance level in this context is a bit different from the normal lingual or understanding of significance. Significance means, well, in a normal language, means something is important or something like that. That's not how it's used in the statistics. In statistics, it's just, a probability measure that says something on whether an observed difference is there due to chance or if it's... You try to set a percentage for the likelihood of getting a result like the one you have just by chance. And there are common levels that we put to this. It could be a 5% level, it could be a 1% level. Depends on what we accept. Depends on several things. But the thing is, we reject the null hypothesis and keep our research hypothesis when... there is, for instance, only a 5% chance to get this by chance or a 1% risk of getting this by chance. So then we reject the null hypothesis and keep our research hypothesis. That's hypothesis testing, and that's what we mean by significance level when we say that there is a statistically significant difference between two groups or two populations or... that there have been a significant raise in temperatures globally the last few years or whatever we try to say something about. When we use the word significant, we mean that there is less than a certain percentage of chance for this to be appear just by chance. So we're not dealing with 50% or more likely than not likely or anything like that. We are pretty conservative here, so... we accept only very low scores for us to reject the null hypothesis. In this process, when you do hypothesis testing, there are two major... errors you can make in the decision-making process. One we call a type 1 error, and the other one is called a type 2 error. And again, this has to do with potential errors in the decision process. And the type 1 error is when we falsely reject the null hypothesis. Okay, we say there is a difference while it actually wasn't. That's a type 1 error, and that's typically a type of active error. which is usually considered to be a bit more serious than the other type of error that you can do, and that is then the a failure to reject a false null hypothesis. You keep the null hypothesis even if there actually is a difference in there. We refer to that as a kind of a passive and conservative type of error. So usually we strive to control for type 1 errors because the consequences there are usually larger as well. You talk about differences with science backing you, that actually isn't true. So one way to avoid or to reduce the chance of doing the active type of error, the type 1 error, is, of course, to increase or raise the bar a little bit. Make it more difficult to do this mistake. And you do that, for instance, by manipulating your significant levels. So if you increase the, or if you actually lower the number, but you raise the bar, you make it more difficult. If you move from 5% to 1%, for instance, you are much less likely to do a type 1 error than what is the case if you go to if you use the 5% level. So this is one way to manipulate things. There are other strategies as well, of course. Doing good experiments, good having control over all external variables. Have ideas about the what an important difference actually is. And this is another comment here, of course. I say that when we talk about statistical significance, we don't necessarily mean important difference. You can have statistically significant results even at a 1% level and at a 0.1% level for that sake, that aren't important at all, because one of the negative things or one of the problems with this hypothesis testing is that the larger your population is, that the more people that are involved, the smaller differences become significant. So when you have a huge, let's say you observe thousands of people, even extremely small differences, which has nothing to do with differences in the real life, which doesn't matter in real life, will become significant. Differences in one or two IQ points have nothing to do with how you function in life. Not at all. But a difference like this between two groups that you observe could easily become statistically significant if you observe enough people. And even more if the overlap between the groups you observe are small. So it's important to see that statistically significant doesn't necessarily mean important or significant in real-world settings. So, as I said, this null hypothesis significance testing, it is um, You can do shortcuts there, because under many circumstances, it might lead to these erroneous conclusions about what's important and not. Maybe things that aren't actually statistically significant now and then, because you have small population, because you have huge variability on the phenomena, are more important than those that comes out statistically significant. So this null hypothesis significance testing is not, well, almost every scientific paper refers to it, but it's also under a bit of criticism now. Because what we see when you study research at a more meta level is that it might, for instance, create way too many what we call false positives, type 1 errors. Because that's the only results that get reported. And among these results, there are false positives. So with a more critical view and with alternative methods to null hypothesis significance testing, maybe you could get better conclusions. You can read this part of this debate. You can find it several places at the link I have here. I'll provide you with these slides. And another important thing that we should include, probably in addition to the criteria of having something to be statistically significant, is at least that you make sure that the results that you actually are testing out statistically and are concluding on have some kind of a theoretical backing. Because if you, well, let's say you study 100 connections, you study the connection between 100 variables and something, between gender and 100 arbitrary or by random variables, and you have a 5% criteria, you would just by chance get five of them falsely come out as, or you would have five of them come out as significant just by chance, right? That's the idea here with chances. So what this calls for is to avoid just fishing in the data without having a hypothesis. So you should be very clear on the expected outcome and have a theoretical backing for this outcome. There are other things to do as well. I can point to one of these, and this is what we call effect size, which is another way to look at the difference that we have between two populations. The effect size is just another estimate of the difference, how big a difference is between two populations. One common one to use is something, a value called Cohen's D, which goes from 0 to something. It can be pretty high. Where a value of 1 means that you have the double the score in one population compared to another one, I think. That's what you will get out of it. And these things are at least supplements and are more and more in use when you read scientific papers, in addition to talking about statistical significance. We also talk about the size of the difference in effect sizes. So those are measures that more and more are in use, and there are tools for this available. G-Star Power is one I mentioned here. There are several more. And it's I've noticed, for instance, that in SPSS, which is the program I use quite a lot for statistics, these power estimations or effect size estimations have come as default settings. So they're done by default. You have to choose them out when you do calculations of differences between groups, for instance. No, let me see if I can do a little bit of statistics here. I'm not sure how that will come out here. Yeah, I just did this today, so I'm not sure how what will come out of it, but the off-campus students, they are, or maybe many of you as well, and this is very preliminary, they are doing a project where, I probably can't see this very well, they're doing a project where they are inviting, and this is also, they're also going to write a small reflection thing on this. They are inviting each of them 15 people, which they should invite personally to take part in a study that I'm also part in. I'm doing this with some colleagues. There is an online questionnaire that they will invite these people to take part in. And in this questionnaire, it's not a central part in my research either, but I'm doing this with some colleagues, psychologists, who are dealing with environmental psychology, how we feel about nature, that stuff. Maybe some of you have been invited to take part of this one, because what the questions that we ask here are, it's a few inventories or a few scales that we want to combine. Some of them we know quite a bit on, others we don't know much about. And the link between them isn't, on that we know even less. So in this questionnaire, we ask questions about what we call sensitivity. How easily excited are you when it comes to things that happen around you? Are you the one that gets scared once you hear a sound? How do you feel about strong and new taste? How uncomfortable are you when you are in a noisy environment? Stuff like that. There are some 25 questions that concerns this, which leads to different types of sensitivity. And we combine this with questions that has to do with sensation seeking, whether you are a person that, this is somewhat a personality trait, are you, how much do you thrive for intense stimuli in the world around you? Are you the one who wants to climb mountains, go to new countries, buy a ticket to the moon if that was possible? Or are you a more relaxed, laid-back guy who wants to have things comfortable and like you're used to have it? So we combine these two, and we combine that with some measures on what we call connectedness to nature. This might be a bit abstract to you now, but how concerned are you about things in nature? How important is that for you? And how much do you feel that you are culture and not nature, for instance? So we ask a few of these questions, and what I've done here is that I I just picked out the few first, I think some hundred and something Norwegian answers to this questionnaire. So the number of responses will become much higher, of course, but what I can do here now is that I can do some statistics more or less on the fly to do some hypothesis testing. And what I typically start with then, and this is something we will do in groups as well later with the data you have, is that I will see over here. Maybe I want to start doing some descriptive analysis of some of these things. I want to do a frequency analysis, for instance. So this is not a course in SPSS. You can see I have a few of these variables here now. Can just add them here. Of course, the number of responses here aren't that high. I want to do different types of statistics. Let's say I want to look at the mean value, the median. I want to see say something about the standard deviation. And I want to see something about the distribution. How close are we to a normal distribution? Can we assume a normal distribution here? And I want to do some charting maybe of this as well. Let's say I want to make histograms out of it with a normal distribution put on top, like that. So when I do that, I get something like this. I have a summary table on top here. So what I see here is that we have 109, or between 109 and 114 valid observations. It's not all I have data for, because some have missing data and then they are excluded for the calculations. So you can see there are different amount of missing data here. What I also see here is that, for instance, when it comes to connectedness to nature, it doesn't say much, of course. It tells us that the mean score for this scale that we are measuring are 43.4 points. It doesn't say anything before you compare it to anything, but it's maybe important to see the standard deviation, which are 7.7. So in the range of 43 plus minus 7.7, 15 points. 43, that where will we be then? We will be between 30 and 60. In that range, we find 68% of the observations, an estimation of that. So it means we probably have a pretty spread out thing. But it's pretty close to being having to do with normal distributions. So this connectedness to nature, for instance, as you can see here, it's the phenomena tends to come out like this when you have several observations. We have a pretty nice distribution that looks pretty much like a normal distribution. So we're not violating any statistics here, because if we are to compare two means, for instance, with methods like students' t-test, which we are using, we assume that we are dealing with normal distributions. And in this case, we actually are, for all these phenomena. Just tell you what they are. The first one is the connectedness to nature scale. The next one is called Arnett's Inventory of Sensation Seeking. And when it says N, it says novelty. How much are you after new things? Or how much do you like the stable, good, nice world? The next one is Arnett's I scale, which is a scale that has to do with intensity of stimuli. You have questions like you answer on a 4-point scale on how well this an expression fits you. And one of the questions is, for instance, it would be interesting to be a witness to a car accident at some point. It's kind of extreme statements that they raise there, but yeah. So people vary quite a lot on these things. So you can see the score here varies from... there are 10 digits in here. I didn't see the range here now, but... I guess I could probably take a quick look at it. So you could see that the when it comes to the AISS intensity scale, for instance, there are two who have scored 14 points, and that's the lowest would be 10 in this case. The highest would be 40, and three people are up to 35 points here. So people vary quite a bit on these things. The next one is, and then you have a total score where you combine the two as well for this Arnett scale. And the next one we have is something called the High Sensitivity Personality Scale or something like that. Arnett's scale on that, Aaron's scale on that. So we have one called Ease of Excitation, for instance, and I think this is AES, is aesthetic sensibility or something like that. How sensitive are you to how beautiful things are around you? Could look at gender differences on these scales as well if you want to play with it now. although there aren't that many participants here. Maybe we should do that and try to, if we want to do some hypothesis testing here, see if let's just take a phony, stupid hypothesis that we want to test based on these things. We say that girls are more sensitive to their environment or to aesthetic qualities in their environment than boys are. I'm not sure if it's true. I'm not sure if it will come out like this with a small population. I don't even know how many boys and girls have responded to this yet. So there are probably differences, but nobody will be offended if I try. I usually say that we shouldn't test gender for these things. And we have a small population here now. So the results that we find is not at all possible to generalize to a general population. But let's now, for the exercise of it, just test some of these, and it's not that it's... the consequences of finding something like this isn't really big, are they? So let's try it. So what I can do then is to do some... I'll do what's called independent samples t-test. That's not the one. So analyze, compare means. You have quite a few things to choose from here. So let's see. So then it will look like this, and then I can just add, I want to look at boys and girls, so I need to find that variable. I have one here, that's gender. I think it has the values 1 and 2. So then I choose that. And what I want to test is the variable called aesthetic sensitivity. Let's just do one of them now. And then you can see I also try to see some, say something about the effect size. So when I do this, I get an output like this. So what I see here is that the mean score for aesthetic sensitivity for boys are 4.2. For girls, it is 4.6. So the mean score is different between the two. So girls score higher in numbers here, in pure numbers. It's the mean value for this on a 7-point scale we are seeing here. So it can be everything between 1 and 7 as a mean score for the numbers or for the parts that goes into this scale. We also see that for these two, when we look at these numbers here, they are pretty comparable when it comes to standard deviation. So the two populations, even though the male population is larger than the female population, there are 75 males here and 38 females who have responded here. The standard the standard deviation on these two are pretty similar. So we can, I guess, compare them. And when we do that, we calculate what's called a t-value, which then is referred to towards the table, and then we get a p-value, and that's the probability value that should be as low as possible and below some threshold that we set. And what we see here then is one-sided and two-sided here means does your hypothesis say that that the change could go both ways or only one way? In this case, I think it's fair to say that we have a two-sided hypothesis. We don't know which way it goes. We know that we assume that boys and girls are different from each other, but we don't know which direction this goes. Right? So we have a two-tailed hypothesis, and then we should look at this number, which tells us that there is the value we get is 0.01, which means 1%. There is 1% chance of getting the difference that we observe just by chance. So girls, in this case, if we use at least a 5% level, because we're way under that, then we could say that girls are more sensitive to their aesthetic environment than boys are, compared to the scores they have here. I think we need some air now because people have used this room right before us, and I feel it's quite warm here, and I see some tired faces around. So let's get some air and meet again in 15 minutes. And if you want me to do some quick other statistics, if you're interested in something based on this data, we can try to do it quite fast afterwards. I'll keep this open so we can check for other connections here, if you're interested. So let's meet is it okay with 10 minutes? Okay. Anyone with ideas to things to look for in this data? No? Let me see one thing I forgot to talk about here in the output. Yeah, we talked about, or I talked about adding to a statistical significant, or these numbers, the number here, to also say something about effect size. Here it would be relevant to look for something called Cohen's D, and the value we get from that is 0.52. And that refers to, by some heuristics or rule of the thumb, that we are dealing with a medium size effect. Higher than 0.8 is called a high effect or a strong effect or a big difference between the groups. So here we are dealing with a medium difference between the groups. And the good thing with, even though the numbers weren't that big here, is that this... Cohen's D, or these estimations of effect size, they don't compensate for, or they don't take into account the number of participants, for instance, which, as I said, would easily give very small differences, statistically significance. So when we get 900 participants in this study, that's extremely relevant to look at and report when you write your paper. When you report the statistics, you usually, in this t-test, for instance, you would report this t-value, which is the output of the statistical procedure, and the p-value. And today, it tended to be, in the old days, you said that it was above 0.5, above 5%, or excuse me, below, for instance, 5%, or below 1%, and you didn't report the exact value. Today you would also report usually the exact value, because you have it. Of course, it gives little meaning to do just call something statistically significant. It's just as good to give the actual value when you get it from the statistical program. So these are values you normally see when you read outputs. And in your exam, you will get something in line with this as well. You will get the output from a student's t-test, which is similar to what I've shown here now. There are other ways that's pretty common to use to show uncertainties in data. And one of these are what we call the confidence interval. And the confidence interval, as we are dealing with uncertainties and spread out values, the confidence interval is an estimated range where a value likely is, the true value likely would be. And that's a very common thing to add to graphical, for instance, illustrations of differences. I can just show you one here. I'm not sure if it's a very good one. In this case, we have... I think this was a study where we had three different groups. And these were then three different conditions, and where we saw at how they were. I think it was an eye tracking study, where we were summarizing the length of the saccades, the movements between that you do in a given time period. And the higher this number is, the more you search around, the more you move your eyes in the given time period. And what we see then within these groups was that people varied quite a bit under the three different conditions. And what the confidence interval tells us here is that in this range, from 60-something to 80-something, I'm not sure what the unit is here, degrees, I think, mean degrees of movement. You could say that there is a 95% likelihood that the true value is in this range. And what we see here is that there is quite a bit of overlap, but there is a clear thing when it comes to group 1 and group 3, where the overlap is hardly are there. So this is another way to say that things are different from each other. So, and it's usually used in addition to other graphical presentations of differences. So you just by adding this, you also add, you could say, a quantification of your uncertainty, which is a good thing. So that's a common thing to do. No, I'll just move ahead here now. I'm not longer talking about the... Do a big leap. We're no longer talking about statistics. We'll do a bit of the statistics. And of course, the main source for information on this should also be the recorded lectures that are putting this in part in more detail. You might, on the exam, get questions from topics that I'm not covering in these summary type of lectures, but that's only on the net. What do we mean by research ethics? Well, in general, what's important to remember is that ethics... Well, at some points, of course, there are rules. There are laws to obey when it comes to treatment of personal data, for instance. You shouldn't publish people's ID, social security ID numbers and stuff like that. So there are laws to follow here. But in general, we are talking about guidelines rather than absolute rules. So it's a collection of things that we need to think about and take into account when we plan, perform, and report research. There are certain things we need to take into consideration. Maybe now and then we, because of... let's say, the importance of our findings based on the need for hiding information, for instance, for subjects. Maybe we now and then do things that violates the guidelines, but then it should be based on, you could say, qualified or... things you considerations that you do, and you should follow these ethical guidelines in general, and they have to do with several things. You could say you could roughly group them into three categories. It has to do with how you treat participants, which of course is important when you have participants there. It usually has to do with what's called informed consent, that you actually tell people what they're taking part in and that they do that participate on a voluntary basis. But it has also to do with treatment of privacy, for instance, that when you report research, you make sure that people aren't identifiable in the data you have or you're dealing with. Ethical concerns also has to do with the more professional issues, that you shouldn't fake data, that you actually present data in a fair way, that you don't do that in an unbalanced way, that you don't change your, you could say, reports or data based on requirements from those who pays you to do the research. It happens. It has happened. But it also has to do with, when it comes to professional issues, how you treat your fellow researchers, that you don't steal data from them, that you give people their fair earned acclamations when people have participated in your study. You refer to them, you let them write papers with you, and stuff like that. I can't, as a professor, for instance, write a paper where you have collected data in a master thesis. Then you would either be the main author or at least the second author if I write the paper based on your data. So that's professionalism, and that's also part of the research ethics that are listed up. Another area that people have been more and more aware of is the, I could say, the relationship between science and society. That science isn't decoupled from the society. You aren't usually coming with the truth and only the truth. And even if you come with the truth, some truth maybe shouldn't be reported. Maybe you should be extra careful when you are reporting data that has to do with sensitive areas, for instance. And we have listed up a few of these areas where you should be extremely careful when you report your science, because there is always a risk of you doing, for instance, a type 1 error when you try to report something. You say there is a difference that actually isn't there or isn't really meaningful at all. And areas like that has to do with gender is one, of course, ethnicity. Could also be more socioeconomic factors now and then, especially if you refer to negative things. Things that could result in more prejudices, more negative things for the society. So at some levels, we should be really careful. I don't think I'll do these details here now. I can just talk about some of the central points. And this also will raise one of the debates here, that is this consideration of to what degree should you follow a guideline. And of course, one central leg when it comes to ethical guidelines is that when you are dealing with people, human participants, you should always follow the principle of informed consent for participation. And that means that people should be informed about all aspects of the research they take part in. And you should also have the freedom then to decline participation at any time. So that's a general principle. principle when it comes to inviting people to take part in research. It should never be obligatory to take part in studies. So you should always inform about these things. And in most cases, this is pretty straightforward. But there are also situations where these things can become more difficult. Of course, grown-up adults, it should be straightforward. You can inform them about everything, and people are qualified to take their well-informed and give consent for participation in a pretty straightforward way. Now and then that seems difficult, seems quite straight to do. But there might be difficulties. I remember once when I was studying, or I was working at a hospital for people with different types of traumatic injuries, neck injuries. So there were some of them were quadriplegic, had neck injuries that made movements more difficult. Some of them could practice using, for instance, what's it called? A training bike where you use your hands, for instance. And what this doctor at this hospital, Sunnaasykehuset, observed, or what this doctor observed, was that among these quadriplegic patients, they saw a lot of, injuries that had to do with, muscle injuries and neck injuries more than they expected based on the type of training they did. And they hypothesized that this had to do with, that when they have this high neck injury, they also produce less stress hormones that gives the body signals to ease down and to prevent injuries to occur. So on this hospital where I was working, and of course I was then about to become the control group for a study, or part of a control group. I think that's a matching group. So they had a patient my age, my size, something like that. And there were several of us who took part in this. And this doctor, Hiesta, I think it's his name was. I shouldn't blame him with name here. When he informed us, he informed me that study that I want you to take part in is a study where you are going to exercise using an exercise bike. And you're doing that for, it will take about an hour or something, so you will be really tired. I was well trained, so I enjoyed this. I thought this was a nice thing. And longer down the page, it said something, and we will take some samples, or we will take a few blood samples to measure your level of stress hormones. What it also said in a paper he gave me was that what they were going to do was that they were going to put in a vein catheter down in my groin here. That was very well hidden in the information there. So actually, the first thing that happened when I came in there, I was put on an operating table, and I had some kind of a small operation, and they put on a crane or something to take my blood samples every 2 minutes or something like that. So it was a pretty extensive thing. This doctor's strategy afterwards was to say that yes, I know this was a bit harder than you expected, and you had to do a bit more than you expected, but please don't tell your friends who's coming later. So was that informed consent? Could they have done this in a different way? the problem there, of course, was that I didn't know. Even though I worked in healthcare, I didn't know what this vein catheter meant. What was it actually? Well, it's also probably a small thing in my arm or something like that. Well, no, it wasn't. It was a much more extensive thing. But I think they could have used another strategy, because his strategy was to try to invite people to participate here by holding back information. In this case, it would probably have invited us anyway. We would easily have become part of this experiment, even with all the information available on top of the page. So I think that was somewhat a violation of a norm, of a good procedure to recruit people. So it was a strategy used. I gave voluntary. I was formally in, had consented or voluntarily took part in this study. I had signed a paper who said that I did this fully voluntarily. But I think he did something he shouldn't have done there. And I think being upfront with all the information is better generally and is what you should do. I guess I should have been I should have been warned when the pay for taking part in this was some 2,000 kroner or something for 20 years ago. That should have raised some warning flag, probably, but it didn't. I was too greedy. There are, nevertheless, situations where you can't give all the information, because information in itself will change the behavior that you're going to measure. And when is that okay to do? Well, some of you who study information security, for instance, if you want to study something called you call social engineering, that has to do with how you make people give away their account information or whatever, passwords, how you lure people into doing things, and under what circumstances are willing to do that. It's important information to have, of course. But if you tell them that that's what you're after, you can't do that, because that will probably change the way you respond to things. And a lot of the studies you do are of that character, and usually we tend to call it deceptive research. One way of doing deceptive research is to, we've done it a lot in psychology, we measure something completely different than what we say we measure. So we set up situations where we fool people into thinking they're part of something else than they are. But again, it is a violation of this general principle of informed consent. You see that? So when you do this deceptive research, you should at least be aware that you do it and think about alternatives. Are there alternative ways of doing this? For instance, one way to do it, which they do in medical experiments, and that's common practice there, they don't say whether you get the true medicine or you get the false or the placebo medicine. When you have these kind of arrangements, one group gets a sugar pill, the other one gets a pill with the medication that you want to check the effect of. And then you give the same information to both groups. We can't say whether you're part of this study or not, or whether you're part of the control group and get a placebo medicine, or if you get the real medicine. Some is in one group, some is in another group. We don't know anything. Then you have given all the information needed, and maybe we can do things like that when we do experimentation as well now and then, for not to. So we should try to be careful when it comes to doing deceptive research. And one strategy, if you need to do it anyway, is to try to at least have some kind of debriefing afterwards. that you meet with people afterwards and tell them what they were part of and why we did it this way. And then, ideally, they could even withdraw their commitment for participation. There are a lot of examples of that type of studies. It can be difficult in these days when it comes to doing things on the net, for instance. You don't necessarily know, and you don't want to know, who took part in an experiment or who were the victim of social engineering in a scientific context. So that makes it even more difficult. So the thing here is, my message here is that don't be too eager to do deceptive research. When you feel that you have to do it, be extremely careful and think about alternatives. Think about ways to inform. That gives you some leeway afterwards. And one of the things you can take into account, for instance, here is that, and this is also a general principle, that there should be a consideration of cost-benefit effects when you invite people to take part in studies. When you do things that where you involve people too much, or even make people hurt a little bit, there should be important things that comes out of it. It shouldn't be just minor details that doesn't mean anything. So when I had an example here of a study where Stanley Milgram wanted to check out how far people were willing to go in punishing people based on pressure from a scientist in this case. That was an extremely important, when he used that to discuss soldiers' behavior during World War II, for instance, it was very important to learn what he learned in these studies, even though we put people under extreme pressure and made some of them really shiver afterwards. You can look up Milgram's obesity study yourself, which is used as an example of this in a lot of cases. And in that case, it's pretty obvious. We learned something important. People are willing to go far when they are under pressure of a, you could say, an authority at an area. Even willing to almost kill people. So that was important information to know. And that justified the, could say, very strict procedures. But none of the stuff we do are in that category usually. But we do things that we should consider now and then. For instance, we steal people's time. If it's really, really minor stuff, why do we want to steal people's time? Is it really worth it to let 50 person in a company spend an hour each in participating in your study, taking away 50 man hours of work that could have been useful for the company? Is that worthwhile? That's a cost-benefit judgment that you do. You study interaction design, for instance, there. Now and then you come into situations where you do, you could say, interface testing with populations, where actually you make people feel quite stupid because they can't really, they feel that they didn't master this task they were set to do. And that's also an ethical thing. Is it worth it then to do that? Is your study so important that it's okay to make people come in these situations? You may, when you test things out, for instance, do things in companies, get in situations where people are actually feeling incompetent in doing their job because they can't handle what they were set to do. So the point is, these are considerations you should make when you do this. And of course, we have the GDPR stuff on privacy and confidentiality. One important thing there is that, and this is all this is quite important to remember. There are regulations when it comes to what type of studies you can do without registering them and having the, you could say, the privacy GDPR things considered. And one, we have one procedure that we have to follow whenever we gather data that has some kind of personal data in it, whenever we know a name, whenever we know an address, whenever these things are involved or there are sensitive issues involved, then we need to notify these projects to a board called NSD, Norsk Senter for Data, I think it's called. They have, you can log in there with Feide, for instance. And for instance, if you run, if you're going to get a, do a study where you have, are doing, you're not gathering necessarily sensitive data, but you are taking up a lot of time and you want to be able to, let's say, get people back to your study, you want to follow them up in several locations, then you have a name somewhere, you have a name registered somewhere. That requires in itself registration with NSD, for instance. We have a lot of information on this on INSIA. So you will find it there. Another thing that that you are asked to consider there is, of course, the traceability, anonymity of data. In general, you can do a lot with anonymous data. You don't have to register a study that's completely anonymous, but things quite easily becomes not so anonymous. For instance, if you use are going in a study, going to use something like, yeah, so let's say you're going to use a questionnaire. And the very easy way to do it is to use Google Forms or something like that. That's the normal way you do this, or some of their competitors. That in itself requires registration of your project in NSD. That's why I've told those of you who are going to do studies here that you can't actually do that. Or you should avoid doing that. There is a way to avoid it. The reason is that they gather IP addresses. And we do that in all this kind of electronic service just to make sure that no robots do answer the questions and that no one person can go in several times, for instance. At least you can check for it. So even though you don't see these IP addresses and are not going to use them for any purpose and are deleting them right away, there is still, you're still registering them, and you don't know what Google are doing with these things. What you should do, and we don't, as a university, have we don't have data handling agreements with Google, for instance. But we do have that with another company, well, not a company, but the University of Oslo has something called Netskjema, for instance, they use, where they take care of the IP addresses the same way as Google Forms does, but it's they make them invisible to us and they delete them afterwards, for instance. So it's, and we have a data treatment agreement with them. So that's Netskjema. You log in there with Feide and you can make as many forms as you like, and that's a pretty okay and straightforward way to avoid registration with NSD. Once you have a written permit for informed consent, samtykkeskjema, you gave information on the sheet and people signed, yes, I want to agree, I do this voluntarily and so on. That was common practice before. But that in itself, that you trigger this signature, that you have this signature available, that in itself also triggers notification of the project with NSD. So I just tell you this because this takes a little time, and whenever you're doing your master thesis, the first thing you should do, and even before you start, you should maybe think about this and start registering your project if it's necessary. If you actually are dealing with even more sensitive data, like health data or stuff like that, you may need to go one step further. You may need to register your project at the regional research ethic boards. So, and they meet only monthly or something. So this has to be planned for. Yeah. I have some comments here on anonymity. That's also a thing. When is something anonymous? We can do a lot of studies when we are have anonymity. That's okay. But remember that even though we don't have names, etc., we can have indirectly traceable data. For instance, now if I'm at a study program here, at one of the technical study program here, want to report how people feel towards a theme, and let's say this was some, I don't know what classes have the worst gender balance, some electrical engineering or something like that, where there are only or more or less only boys and a few girls. Of course, then if you're reporting gender differences and there is only one or two girls, it's easy to trace the answers of these back to the one or two participants there. So it's that's important to take into consideration here. I just wanted to point out before we end this. I think this was a bit fragmented, but. We have this, let me see, this one. This is a very good source for information on research ethics, and I think it's a good idea if you mark this and take a look at these things. It's the Norwegian, it's for several areas we have committees that are working on guidelines on how to conduct research in an ethical way. So there are different areas where people have worked with this, and if we go to guidelines here, for instance, so there is a Norwegian and an English version of all this. They have marked out several fields, and for you, maybe you could look at the general guidelines, or maybe some of you could look at the guidelines for science and technology. That's probably relevant. So if I do that, you could find this guidelines for research ethics in science and technology. So it can also be downloaded as a PDF. I highly advise you to take a look at these things. And what it says here is, of course, it says something about the obligations for research to society. It says something about scientific integrity. It says something about risk assessments, protection of research subjects, and so on. This is a very good source of information on ethics, the National Committees for Ethics in Research. I think it's funded by the Norwegian Research Council or something. Okay, I think that's it for today. It was a very warm room to be in today. So you are good when you manage to stay awake.